So, you know, I've traveled in from Dallas. My name is Mark Schaebel. I'm actually in my day job. I work for the American Heart Association. I'm the Executive Vice President for Advocacy. So I am a lobbyist by trade, by training, and by experience, and I have the reputation of talking very fast, ignoring my slides, and going off message, but always to a point. So I'm sure you'll be able to kind of hold me accountable today to see if I stick with that tradition. And I have, obviously, you know, the privilege to be able to speak today on something that's very dear to my heart, because this is not what I do during my day job. You know, during the day, I'm responsible for the government relations activities of the American Heart Association. Yes, we have been around 80-plus years and still haven't quite, you know, combated heart disease and stroke to annihilation. But certainly, you know, we know that as the American Heart Association, we will never accomplish our mission, our vision of a heart-healthy and stroke-free country without the power of collaboration and partnerships. And that's why, you know, being able to speak to you today about one of those partnerships, one of those truly historic collaborations, is truly my honor and privilege. And also, it is my honor and privilege, as Jay has alluded, that I actually am standing here before you as the first chair of the National Forum that is from outside of the CDC, which I think is very historic and very daunting on a daily basis when the work of the National Forum rests on the shoulders of its partners and not on its host or agency of origin, which I think speaks to the strength of what we have. But let me start off, and it's great. You know, I consider myself almost like an after-dinner speaker because it's, what, 7 o'clock Central East Coast time? So this is kind of like after-dinner. You all got aisle seats, so that's a good thing too, right? But, you know, think back to where you were in 2001. Now, I happen to be in the public health agency in Iowa, but we all probably were somewhere in 2001. We can remember where we were. Think about what kind of planning activities you were involved in. When you think about what kind of public health planning that you were doing at the time and what the results of those planning were, and then here's the key question: are you still engaged with partners to implement that plan? And here we are today talking about the National Forum, which has in its origins the work that dates back to 2001 and the development of a public health action plan to prevent heart disease and stroke. And I'm here today to share with you the activities of the National Forum that grew out of that effort. But I would like to take maybe just go back a little bit and talk about what the advancing slides would be. I want to just talk a little bit about kind of touring through the years of the origins of the Public Health Action Plan and subsequently the National Forum. And it has a rather inauspicious origin. In 1998, I'm looking to Nell, who's in the audience. You know, we had, for the first time, Congress establishing a state grant program to support states in their efforts to prevent and to work on cardiovascular disease. Certainly something before that, you know, states were doing their best to cobble together PHHS block grant dollars and other resources to be able to confront the number one and number three leading causes of death in our country. But only with the enactment of this program, the establishment of this program in Congress, did we really start establishing a home within our lead public health agency for cardiovascular disease. And that subsequently really transitioned to the CDC and NHLBI really working as co-lead agencies on developing our shared goals in Healthy People 2010 for the prevention of heart disease and stroke and the reduction of risk factors. And certainly from that, I think that with the establishment of those national goals and goals that we all collectively shared, there was an immediate recognition that what was missing is a true collaborative plan to rally the public health community to engage and partner with each other to address those gaps, to fulfill our mission, and to work together on advancing the goals of Healthy People 2020. So in 2001, under the leadership of the CDC, we started a process of charting a course for change and really developing what ultimately became the Public Health Action Plan to prevent heart disease and stroke. So over the course of 2001 and 2002, the CDC and the work of a number of partners brought together 10 expert panels to develop what is a very comprehensive document of recommendations on what we could do within the public health community as partners, as a number of different and very distinct organizations, on how we could work together to fill the gaps on what we were not accomplishing with our own efforts and where our energies and synergies could have even a greater impact on achieving the goals that we have set out for ourselves. And by 2003, the Public Health Action Plan was born. I'll go off of script here a little bit by saying that, you know, it truly was a reflection of a tremendous amount of work and effort, not only of federal agencies, but then also of these private partners, nonprofit organizations. You know, we had the full spectrum of patient advocacy groups. We had a spectrum of faith-based organizations and advocacy organizations. Sometimes you'd say that those are one and the same. I'll assure you that there's a lot of faith in when you try to advocate for change, and certainly can appreciate that it took everybody coming together to develop the Public Health Action Plan. And by virtue of development of the Public Health Action Plan, we realized that finally now, for the first time, we had a rallying cry, we had an umbrella document, we had a chart, a framework for directing what we needed to do collectively within the public health community to address heart disease and stroke. But the work only started there in 2003, and as we think back of it, as I think back, it's been only a short 5 years. But the challenge, as you know, is once you put out a public health action plan, once we develop any kind of strategic planning document, what is our greatest fear? What is the greatest risk we have? There's fanfare, which we had in 2003 with Tommy Thompson's, that's probably me, Tommy Thompson's, I guess it was Steps for a Healthier U.S., the first conference of the STEPS program, that we had great fanfare, a great rollout of the Public Health Action Plan. But then after it's done, after the signing ceremony, after we congratulate each other and pat ourselves on the back for what a beautiful document we created, what a brilliant vision we've painted for ourselves, now what? Does that document sit on a shelf? Is it only a testimony to our own efforts to talk to one another and not actually to translate into actions that benefit the constituents we were most concerned about? And under the leadership of Dr. Darwin LaBarthe, who we consider to be the godfather of the Public Health Action Plan, this action plan did not sit on the shelf. And in fact, we established a framework for being able to continue to develop the action plan as a living document, and that has what has become to be known as the National Forum. The National Forum is a collection of volunteer organizations and federal agencies that are committed to implementing the Public Health Action Plan. Over the course of our 5 years, we've had approximately 170 organizations come in, engage, sometimes leave the work that we've been doing as a collective partnership in implementing this Public Health Action Plan. Currently, we have over 80 organizations involved and over 130 individuals involved in implementing the plan. Over the course of the years, we've kind of evolved where we had to, one, take a look at, okay, now we thought we could do everything, but, you know, if you try to accomplish everything, you're going to accomplish nothing. So we had to narrow our focus. We had to figure out how we're going to start working together to implement, and then to figure out where our early successes could be. And that has been the work of the National Forum over the last 5 years. A couple things I wanted to point out is, you know, when we think about why the National Forum is successful, there's a couple things that we point to that really keeps us, I think, a very dynamic and active partnership, as Jay has described it. One of the things is the annual national forum that we sponsor and we host as a collaborative under the Public Health Action Plan for Heart Disease and Stroke. But let me just caution you, because I think that we very early on recognized this as a risk, is we are not a national forum that only hosted an annual conference. We look at the national conference as a once-a-year opportunity to bring in the leading experts in cardiovascular health to help continue to challenge our assumptions, to refine our thinking, and to adjust our plan so we're focused on the things that could be most impactful in our work in public health. These national forums have now been going on. I think we're planning on hosting our 7th national forum, as you can see, in 2009. And it will continue that tradition of, again, shaping our thinking, adjusting our plans and visions and our priorities for the future, and most importantly, being an opportunity to get together and be a catalyst to continue the work that we've been doing as a national forum. But when you think about it, where is that work occurring? I describe the National Forum as a confederation of independent partners who are working together under a common cause. And what we have is implementation groups. These are almost autonomous implementation groups that have taken a chapter of the Public Health Action Plan and have been given the responsibility to, amongst themselves and the individuals involved and interested in that particular area, focus on the priorities we've set and to implement strategies in which we can achieve the goals that we set out for ourselves. We have 7 implementation groups, and let me just very quickly and with a lot of pride describe a little bit about what each of these implementation groups are doing. The Action Priorities Implementation Group, that's kind of our policy arm. And that particular group is working on advancing public policy that really achieves the vision of the Public Health Action Plan. They've been working on looking at issues of building the resource base to support the infrastructure that we know we need at the federal, state, and community level to address cardiovascular disease. They've been active in very specific issues. If you look at healthcare reform, sodium, other issues that we certainly see at the forefront of good, effective public policy that advances our priorities. What's, I think, important to mention is the individual who's leading this particular implementation group is a physician with Kaiser Permanente. And as I describe each one of these, I'll just mention a little bit about where the leadership comes from. With the communications, again, this is a group that's focused on internal and external communications, both supporting the work within the national forum, but also bringing our work forth to the broader public health community and to the attention of the public. Individual leading this is from Fleischmann Hillard, as you may know, a public relations firm. We have an implementation group looking at monitoring and evaluation. And this particular group was very instrumental in the publication of a journal article in the AHA Journal Circulation, looking at the fundamental challenges we have as a society in monitoring and evaluating the incidence and prevalence of cardiovascular risk and cardiovascular disease. And this particular group has been active in looking at how we as a country can close those gaps. The individual leading that group at the time was from Wake Forest, one of our university partners. Organizational Compassion, Public Health Leadership and Partnership, again, knowing that in order to effectively execute on our Public Health Action Plan, we need to work with state health departments and be able to develop that community-level infrastructure necessary to implement effective programs, and knowing that we could support both the development of that capacity, the nurturing of that kind of professional ability to execute on those programs, then also to instill the leadership necessary that we felt was essential if we were ever to accomplish our vision. And if you look at the individuals involved at the National Forum at this level, it is truly individuals that have come from the community, have come from state health authorities, and are now shaping at the national level the work that we can do collectively to support them in their important efforts. Similarly, as we look at policy research and regional global partnership, we see again the opportunity to involve partners in areas that really drive the policy research agenda for cardiovascular disease research and prevention research. Currently, their focus is on the health economics of making the case for support for chronic disease and cardiovascular disease. Finally, with regional global partnerships, the one thing I would want to make sure that I'd stress, and I would feel remiss if I did not mention, is that the National Forum, although it does suggest a domestic effort on the part of partners within the United States, truly is international in its effort. We have the Public Health Agency of Canada as a partner. We have the World Health Organization. We have the, we have a number of global partners involved in the National Forum. Again, looking at how we extend the reach of our work internationally, but then how do we learn from the lessons of our international colleagues and bring that work back to the efforts that we have at home. So I'm going to just close by sharing just a couple final observations, and we'll look forward to our dialogue, Jay, in that what has made the National Forum successful. As I mentioned, the Public Health Action Plan has been published now for over 5 years. It's been out there. The work that we've accomplished as a National Forum is something I think collectively we take great pride in. And as we think about the ingredients for success, and this is the ingredients that we know is the success of any effective collaboration, it's one, that we're unified under a common vision. And that common vision, that common goal is the implementation of the Public Health Action Plan. And the fact that we're refining that vision on an annual basis and just recently published an update of our Public Health Action Plan, that we have the commitment of partners who truly both share that vision and are willing to put in the sweat equity, to put in the commitment, to put in the resources to be able to implement strategies that none of us could accomplish by ourselves. The third ingredient, I think, is that we have an infrastructure that's available to support this work. And I know I haven't talked about this, but we are very lucky to have the ability to have some support from the CDC to be able to support the infrastructure, the staff support, the mechanics, the logistics of being able to implement some of the strategies of the national forum. And I think fourth, obviously, is the ability to then create both opportunities and then to be able to assemble the resource necessary to execute on the strategies and the plans that we developed. And finally, and I think that this is something that continues to develop, is that we're developing a legacy of success. There are things that we can point to in our first 5 years that we know have made a difference. There are things that we can point to in the first 5 years of the National Forum that we know would not have happened had it not been for this collective effort. And I think that there's great pride on the individuals that who are involved in the National Forum, that they see the National Forum as something that's establishing a legacy of excellence within the partners in the public health community. And finally, I get a kick out of, you know, I'm the chair of the National Forum, and I hate to say this, but it is almost a six-year commitment. You spend 2 years as chair-elect, 2 years as chair, and 2 years as immediate past chair. And I'm now in my second two-year cycle, and I'm seeing the end already. And what made me smile the other day is when you're in the heat of battle, sometimes you think that this has been going on forever. And my successor, who's Tom Pearson out of the University of Rochester, in describing how his vision for what he wanted to accomplish after I completed my tour of duty, described it as, the National Forum is only in its infancy, and its greatest years are yet to come. And so I think that is true testimony that we have established a legacy, and we truly do see that this collaboration is truly just starting to scratch the surface of what we can accomplish through effective partnerships. So thank you, Jay.
Thank you very much, Mark. And you can see the energy that Mark and the forum, I think, has really been generating. I wanted to point out just one personal observation. When Mark mentioned the working groups, one of the things that I found personally unique about this is that each member, either an organization or an individual, is actually involved in providing input. It's not a passive from the center out to our members. It's really been a partnership. And I think this has been one of the most exciting developments because there's really a sense of that two-way reward, learning and benefiting at the same time some input. And in keeping with that, I'm very privileged to introduce Gladys Brannick, who will talk about some of strengthening the programs on the state and local level, because again, it's not only grassroots, but I think Gladys too, in her experience as a health officer of Manatee County, Florida, provides a grassroots look at it, but at the same time active in NACHO shows again that notion of the power of collaboration and the organizations that have come together initially. Gladys, I'm very pleased to turn the podium over to you. Yeah, and it's just left click.
Yes, sir. If a picture is worth a thousand words, these certainly qualify, because no words could clearly describe just how much suffering people experience on a daily basis who have heart disease and stroke. Ralph Emerson once said, "Your first wealth is good health." When cardiovascular disease is present, energy does not express itself. Independence does not sustain itself. And for some, many of their daily routines are significantly altered forever. Now, even though these pictures are compelling, they do not tell the whole story. They do not tell us that heart disease and stroke is the first and third leading cause of death in the United States. They do not tell us that the estimated cost of heart disease and stroke for 2008 is $448.5 billion. They do not tell us that the major public health problem affecting this group is 80.7 million. Why, that is four times the population of the state of New York. That number exceeds the population of California, Texas, and New York combined. These alarming statistics underscores the importance of strengthening heart disease and stroke prevention programs. And that's why I'm here today, to talk about collaborative population-based approaches, the overarching goal to improve the health status of all. Now, the state certainly has a very important role in this area for directing us and guiding us and assuring that the implementation of primary prevention-oriented strategic plan is done, for analyzing surveillance data system, and most of all, for informing our legislators that it is so important to address heart disease and stroke prevention. So I'd like to say that it's so important that every segment of our local community be involved and play an active role. And we certainly, there are many programs throughout this great country that employ community-based collaborative approaches. And when I say that, I'll start with our private clinicians, our primary care physicians, our family doctors, our OBGYN doctors. Certainly when the pregnant women have gestational diabetes, they can be referred to our health department for nutrition counseling. Our Healthy Start program, 0 to 5, can also play a role in referring to the health department. And our school board in our county, in Manatee County, we work with some of the middle schools. And what we do is we actually have our school nurses already in the school. They take the height and weight and BMI, and then our WIC, our nutritionists, come along after that and they do presentations. But they make them very visual. They will go in and for example, they will say, if you consume a 12-ounce can of Coca-Cola every day for a full year, and then they are put on the table 4 2-liter bottles of sugar and say, this is the amount of sugar that you have consumed just by drinking one 12-ounce can of Coca-Cola every day. But you and I know that many of our young children drink 20-ounce bottles of Coca-Cola. So you can imagine that would translate into 6 or maybe 7 2-liter bottles of sugar. So and the kids get very engaged in things like that. We teach them how to read labels, food labels in middle school. We emphasize the importance of a healthy snack. For example, eating baked potato chips rather than the fried ones. Eating a granola bar rather than a cookie. Eating yogurt rather than a milkshake. So we make it fun and extremely visual, and usually the school board approves of this. And it really, we have seen some significant differences in the BMI scores at the end of the school year. Our AHEC program, Train the Trainer, very, very important. What we do, Area Health Education Coalition, where we go into the community, work with the lay people. We train junior high school students, high school students, to go in their own communities to give messages, important messages about the signs and symptoms of cardiovascular disease, of a heart attack, of stroke disease. And that is working extremely well. And we use their language. You know, many people have heard the expression, a stitch in time saves nine. Well, we'll say things like, you know, stop 1 pound and save nine. Because as you know, that if you just have 1 pound or 2 pounds, it's easier to deal with that than, say, 10 pounds. So we get that those messages out. We there can be a lot of work done with your county extension programs wherever you are. Go in and do container gardening, and you can actually get not only the adults, but the young folks involved in doing this container gardening. You bring in the seeds and the soil, and it's quite a bit of fun. We've also done this at the international level in the Bahamas. And also do cooking classes, and that's where it's so important, because many times it's not what you eat, but how you prepare the food. So we work with members of the entire family, the grandmothers who may actually be cooking the food. And so that's gotten a lot of results. And also cooking demonstrations in your faith-based group, your churches. Many of the churches will have health ministries. And they more than welcome people coming in and giving demonstrations. And what's so good about it is after the demonstration, the cooking demonstration is done, you can actually go out and take a walk with the group around the block. So what better way of getting the active buy-in from people in that particular community? Meals on Wheels. Certainly is in all of your communities, I'm sure. Folks from health department can go in and give presentations on healthy nutritional choices. Same thing is true for home health care, employers, worksite wellness. That's a way to go in and get your employers all fired up and actually make some money while you're doing it. Because you are, after all, helping them to improve their bottom line. And what do I mean by that? Because when you go in with the worksite wellness and have the folks know their numbers, what you will see is absenteeism goes down, productivity goes up, and people are out less. And it's less expensive in insurance costs. So the workers really like that. And what we do also is tell them to know their numbers, certainly their weight, their cholesterol numbers, and depending on the employer, because it may be a camp where they're working with the in the fields. And we use different terminology there. We wouldn't say HDL or the good, we'll just say the happy cholesterol or the lazy cholesterol. And usually that tends to get people excited and they respond quite well. Physical inactivity is another risk factor for heart disease and stroke. So we work with the private clinicians, primary care physicians for referrals, and at the health department or even at some of your local organizations, you can have exercise classes. The school board also we work very closely with. School nurses at Worksite Wellness, they actually get the teachers and administrators involved in that. It's also possible to work with the physical education instructors. One deviation that they had is they had a jump rope contest, and they had people, over 600 kids with jump ropes. So that really energized that particular population. And then physical activities can also be utilized with the organizations with emphasis on children, things such as your Girl Scouts, your Boy Scouts, your Just for Girls Club, your Boys and Girls Clubs. All of these different kinds of clubs can be utilized. The American Heart Association is actively involved. They're all over the country with walkathons, health fairs, and don't forget to your senior citizens and your assisted living facilities with strength training. And we've also developed a video for chair exercises. And what we encourage is that little by little, you can get great results. So we don't encourage them to go out and do things that will exert them and cause them not to engage in exercise again, but to take it slowly, gradually, one bit at a time, and the results are spectacular. Another way for you to engage folks in collaborative approaches for the reduction of heart disease and stroke is to emphasize the dangers of smoke, not only regular, but secondhand smoke as well, especially with the children. And we work with the private clinicians and have them to refer to the health department for the smoke and cessation programs. And also there's quitline information that's available. And partnering also with the WIC and Healthy Start program. Also, the students working against tobacco, our SWAT program, and I think there are folks like that around the country. They're very, very effective, very engaging in the community. But let's not leave out our media, our radio, television campaigns, and our senior citizens with educational presentations. And what happens if we do not do those activities that I've just described? We'll only come back with heart attacks and more rehabilitation for stroke. But we know that from our latest 2008 Trust for America's Health study that if we spent $10 per person per year on prevention strategies, that we could realize, this country could realize savings of $16 billion annually within 5 years. And if we engage in those activities collectively and consistently, energy will express itself. Independence will sustain itself. And our families, our communities, our state, and our nation will reap the benefits of a heart-healthy and stroke-free society.
Thank you very much, Gladys. And I have the, as I say, the to follow Gladys is a privilege, but it's also a challenge. And on top of that, to be Tom Pearson is something that I have to say in all due truth. I feel somewhat humble. Tom cannot be here today. He wanted to come. He's a professor, a cardiologist at Rochester University. An eminent scholar internationally, worked in developing countries, and he was called because today is the dedication of a new wing of research that of which he's a prominent member in Rochester. So he does extend his apologies. But what I'd like to do to pick up on the theme and what I know Tom feels passionate about, and we do, all of us in the forum. Tom just finished an NIH faculty stay, and which again was to bring research in line with priorities and action, and form the communities that we're talking about to work together. And certainly the regional and global collaboration as outlined by Mark is again an active group, and it has membership, as Mark was saying, from Canada, from Latin America, and now we're extending it out to Europe, and I hope also to include China and the Asian regions. And of course, this mirrors the voluntary groups that are working in all these countries. The confreres of the American Heart Association, International Heart Association, and stroke groups. So again, it's built around this unifying framework. The multinational membership is important because, as you know, if there has ever been a field, I mean that in heart disease and stroke prevention, control, and research, that has benefited from both domestic and international work, it's heart disease and stroke. I mean, consider the findings, early findings here, for example, on Japanese generational effects from Japan and in the West Coast, the NISI and ISI, to look at effects of heart disease and stroke, or the Nordic studies that have taken place, or the British first looking into now what we call disparities, the British inequities in terms of social class, the effects of social determinants, also the British physician study. So in short, it has a strong tradition of domestic and global research. I put this chart in because the Medicine Public Health Initiative is now working with our Chinese compatriots, and we have picked, again, the Chinese picked heart disease and stroke, added diabetes into it as a major challenge. This is a WHO chart, which shows along the top of where China is now with men in 2005, and where, if the current trends will be in 2015, some less than 10 years later, in terms of overweight and obesity, and also mirrored for women 2005 and 2015, with the blue being good, the gold being bad, and this remarkable epidemiologic transition that's taking place in countries that have been noted for lack of obesity, but to look at the global dynamics that are taking place, you can definitely call this a reversal of fortune for both men and women. And this is mirrored, incidentally, in Beijing in terms of hypercholesterolemia, that you can see these rising rates as processed food and lifestyles change, sedentary lifestyle. So again, this is a global call for action in which maybe the U.S. may be in the forefront, sadly, in terms of rates, but developing countries as well are quickly accelerating. And this is, so if we look at our current efforts, I wanted to hook in something Tom is saying about this, is that these advocacy efforts in global and collaborative research, coupled with what Mark was saying, for example, on our communication group of how to shape messages and proof points, as they call them, both for a domestic and global connected program. Some very specific activities to show what an implementation group does, in this case, the global group, is they're now organizing an inventory of international agencies, a guide to who's doing what where, a wayfinder for those of us who want to get involved. And to back that up, this current bibliography of key policy and research publications, I want to say this is very importantly, all up on the website. So this is truly what we talk about when we say Web 2.0, namely using the new networking and social interconnectedness, but providing that evidence-based facet. If we consider opportunities for training, the worldwide shortage, which is only going to get worse, projected by WHO manpower studies, of a kind of collapsing back of trained manpower, person power in countries at all levels of heart disease and stroke dissemination. Another important facet is the idea of recommendations. Let me give you two examples that I think are critical. For example, Mark referred to sodium reduction, and we all know how much salt, as the previous director of heart disease, heart, lung, and blood said, that as commercial processors of food determined that fat was not a good thing to advertise their product, so they withdrew fat. But at the same time, to quote, give flavor, they increased sodium content. And again, this is a worldwide phenomena. So if you look at the notion of sodium intake, there are policy discontinuities, which the forum has identified along with other researchers in pushing. So, for example, in countries who are fighting iodine-deficient diseases, they're using iodized salt. But the level of salt intake to get proper iodine content is above the recommended level for salt intake. So here's an example of two worthy policies that are butting heads against each other. So harmonizing results is important. A second example I would give is that in almost every country, and I know this is true in China, for example, less than 50% of persons post-initial stroke are ever advised to take an aspirin on a daily basis as a prevention of a reoccurring stroke. So simple outcome measures are available to close these disparities that we see in terms of providing effective health information and prevention. And this is aside from the message Gladys was giving on primary prevention. So I think in conclusion, this identification and expansion of research programs, particularly in low-resource countries, is a priority for the national and global forum. I'll just give one example that we and the MPHI have benefited from it. We have a dual language site now in English and Chinese, and it's been such an amazing and productive activity to provide abstracts of some of the work that the national forum has done in Chinese, so they can be easily read and motivate people to understand that this is truly an important global exchange. So MPHI, I'm using that as an illustration of being a direct beneficiary of the work of the National Forum, as well as, of course, advertising the website for healthy life and stroke-free. So let me stop at this point and talk about some conclusions and open it up for comments from the audience. On the one hand, APHA has historically been a strong proponent in building national and global alliances. We've done this from day one. Do you know when, as I see Ginny here, a prior president of APHA, when I was looking into internationalism in APHA, there was a 25-year period around the turn of the century in which 8 of the APHA presidents came from outside the United States. And they included Canada, Mexico, and Cuba among the several presidents of APHA. So I wanted to come say something about back to the future of the international nature that APHA has been from the very beginning, including our public health service and marine hospitals, to today, and surely that statement that says now that a disease that happens someplace in the world can happen anywhere in the world. And clearly this is the story of the APHA involvement and our vision for building alliances. I'll just conclude by saying I hope those of you here who are interested will fill out a little contact sheet on your way out so that we can, or have suggestions for how to engage APHA membership. So let me conclude at this point and ask if there are any questions or comments. And thank you. Ginny.
Many of them have collaborative approaches for physical inactivity or for diabetes or for some of the other risk factors for heart disease and smoking. So yes, there are, and the media is actively involved in that as well.
And I would add as well, you know, although we're present in a number of communities, you know, our volunteers, obviously, you know, I think that as they look at what can change in their own community and take ownership and really try to seize that opportunity to have an impact, you know, in one case, it might be a group getting together to change the policy in their school district. Another might be going to the Planning and Zoning Committee to talk about the importance of walkable communities. And yet a third group, you know, lobbying their city council about clean indoor air. And it's interesting, as you look at this, it coalesces around the opportunity and not necessarily a coalition that's freestanding just to address cardiovascular disease in all of its different manifestations, but rather really kind of where the opportunity presents itself and those individuals most passionate about taking action on that issue because it touches them personally.
Jay, I'm surprised about the China obesity rate. I really am, because I don't know why, I just have this in my mind that there's a lot more people on the country and landscape areas, so that they're more likely to be physically active as opposed to people in big cities where there's a lot of technology and they don't move around. So I guess I was surprised at that.
Well, when you go to rural parts of China, you'll find mostly older people and very young children there, because the income is being made primarily in the east in factories and manufacturing. And so they go and live these very hardworking lives, essentially the younger people working, sending remittances back home. And in fact, most of the farming, at least talking to people in villages, has pretty much become subsistence. They can raise enough for themselves, but like farmers everywhere, they have a problem with cash crops. So there's a very serious policy in China. Incidentally, the Chinese government, I was reminded, declared only one of their five-year plan policies a failure over the 50 plus years of the People's Republic, and that was their health policy. And they've officially declared it a failure and now having to turn back at the cusp of deciding which way to go. So again, this is an extremely opportune time, and I can say where China is looking for guidance, knowing that all of us are imperfect in where we are. The other point I think I would make about the collaboration, I have the privilege of being the membership chair, so let me talk about not what we've accomplished, but what we haven't accomplished. And that is a list of members that we need to have more input from. We had our first patient, as Mark referred to, patient advocacy group join us recently. But there are so many partners out there, just as APHA did with emergency medical services some years ago, prior to 9/11, putting together a coalition. We need to bring in all these people that are there. Red Cross is interested in these activities. And this power of bringing, as Mark was referring to, and Gladys, of local level action cannot be underestimated. And surely we need to tap. Well, I think it's going to only accelerate it, because if you think about the melamine, for example, in food supply, there were articles prior to the Olympics in the Chinese papers, public papers, talking about the fact that at least 25% of their food supply is unsafe. And in places where they see green tide of chemicals coming down to the water supply because of a spill in a chemical plant upstream, and the local leaders are telling them the water is safe. There has been a crisis of confidence in people in China about environmental and food sanitation, let alone the environmental impact. So I think it's building on this, that the Chinese rising expectation themselves are going to carry momentum forward. Yes?
Can you develop when the alliance was put together? Was it put together because people felt that there was a need, that there was lacking the ability for the groups, health groups within the country, to see how we can impact cardiovascular disease, stroke, that the American Cardiology Association and all these other groups,
excellent question, and you know, my reflection on answering that is, at the time, I think when we brought together the expert panels, it was more a recognition that what was lacking is a common public health vision for what the public health community could be doing to advance the Healthy People 2010 goals and the work of preventing heart disease and stroke. I think at the end of that work, once they had produced the public health action plan, it was then recognizing the importance of what we were recommending, wanting and desiring to have something in place that would then start holding us accountable, individually and collectively, to work together to actually realize that vision. And so I don't think going into it, we wouldn't necessarily, as the American Heart Association, going into development of the plan, had envisioned the creation of the national forum. But as a result of recognizing all the gaps and the important work that is yet to be done, wanted to have that sustained, and knowing that individually we would do great work, but collectively we could have even a greater impact, and not just augmenting what we would be doing, but then also identifying where there were gaps, where the National Forum would be the unique niche organization to be able to take on those issues, where no one other group or no one partner organization would have the resources or necessarily the interest in trying to take that on as an organizational priority.
And I thought, Gladys, your point about how heart disease and stroke touches so many families, I mean, and is so much a part of our everyday life, that becomes a real touchstone. I'd actually thought, and this is very a sort of unofficial view of things, of really the forum is a kind of analogy to community development. You know, and as both Mark and Gladys described, with is this community of interest, and we kind of like bowling alone. You know, that we recognize that we really had to come together, and the principles that have been used, which I think is absolutely very positive, are essentially the principles of community organization, how to create linkages, how to build trust, how to take on some projects that really bring some success and reward to the various levels. And we haven't articulated that as such, but that's the path that we've followed. And I think that's all too good, whether some people think of community development as socialism, as said on the national election, or whether we think of it as good citizenship, which was in our Constitution about promoting the domestic well-being. Gladys, did you have any comments at all?
No, not other than to say that there's a lot of emphasis on the family. When we do counseling, for example, nutrition counseling, we bring the whole family in. If there's a need for additional services, for example, if someone is bulimic, we refer that person to the appropriate agency. So it is family-oriented, community-oriented.
And I think the WHO pointed out, they did a very nice piece on chronic diseases recently, two years ago. And they had the top 10 myths about chronic disease. And the first one was that it's inevitable. It's just part of aging. And this whole idea of redressing this image that it's just something foreordained is the number one problem. And then that, again, comes back to the role of associations and local leaders and organizations, health departments, schools, to really change the message.
Okay, that brings up another issue then. Most of my life has been in the medical model of healthcare, and just since 2004, transitioning into public health and further education. When are we going to put a little bit more emphasis on our medical schools to be able to integrate the public health and medical model? Because I can tell you that my doctor still tells me, just as of 3 weeks ago, well, this is a result of getting old. And you say, no, oh no, you don't. Just what you said. When is this going to integrate there so we can begin to change? And this is a young physician. It's not an old physician. When are we going to change the medical education piece so this is integrated better?
Well, maybe someone has a response here. Jenny, you've wrestled with this.
Yeah, it's a really tough issue. Part of the issue, I think, with schools, I'm at a medical school here at Indiana University, and part of the problem is, I think, is how we do, and I hate to say this, it's terrible to say, but I think how we do our reimbursement. We focus so much on our expenditures of reimbursements on the that if we could ever get where we're spending more money on prevention, what you're talking about, the public health part would be more interwoven in the curriculum of what we're teaching these students and then these residents. So it's a slow argument. You hear they talk about it all the time, they do a good job about talking about it. It's where you put your money.
Yes.
That counts, and so I think that has a lot of influence. We're slowly getting there. I mean, it's a slow process. It's slowly getting there. I think we're going to get to the point where chronic diseases, 70% of all the healthcare costs is chronic diseases. They're going to have to get to the point that they're tired of fixing these cars when they break down. They got to change that oil and those filters.
Well, that was one of the two messages. I was at a European forum on health this summer, and the two messages that are old to us in public health but show that what you're saying, there are clarion calls from other places, was one, that the fact that they had to move, Europe cannot solve its problems by the sick care system They had to move upstream to prevention because they're being overwhelmed by the, quote, success of their society and people living longer. And the other aspect was of foundations and places realizing that it's not enough to work one disease at a time. If you can't have a health delivery system that has these messages, particularly of prevention and engagement, then it's not going to work. And say it's not there yet. One good thing, Baylor College of Medicine, one example of a change though, did a survey of their juniors, the third year medical students. And they asked them what they hadn't learned so far that they thought they should know more about. And according to the faculty of medicine who analyzed this at Baylor, 3/4 of them had to do with public and community health. So these are spots, but as you're also saying, when you try to get into a medical school curriculum, they may give you 2 hours. Or there's no role models to reinforce these.
Here relies an opportunity for those of us in public health to go to, I'm a member of the Medical Society Division, a member of the Medical Society. We can actually go to the Medical Society meetings and get on some of their programs and talk about how we can work collaboratively to push prevention more, and also meet with our legislators and get them involved and get our media to write articles about prevention. And we can also work with the cable companies and have them do programs on that, because it takes all of us.
And I'll just make one comment, and this is where the national forum is looking as we look in our crystal ball in 2009. You know, everything is an opportunity. You know, the fact that our national economy cannot sustain the expenses of our healthcare system is a true opportunity. This is an opportunity to drive the prevention message, and we can all be very pessimistic about the challenges of the new administration, the next incoming Congress, this country is facing. It is simply going to be about choices. And it's going to be up to the voters, it's going to be up to our elected officials to make the right choices when it comes to shifting from being a care delivery system to a delivery system that rewards and values prevention. And, you know, it just strikes me, and we've just ran the numbers again, the fact that we demand clinical effectiveness, evidence of clinical effectiveness, to add the latest drug, device, medical information, those things that are reimbursable. But somehow when it comes to prevention, it has the extra hurdle of not only being effective, but it has to save money. And then we're not going to do it because it adds quality of life, there's societal savings, rather than there has to be that demonstrated medical cost savings. And what kind of message is in the society we're willing to spend on secondary prevention with no cap or no restrictions, but on primary prevention and certainly those things we know are effective, we somehow hold it to a higher standard. Just mind-boggling. But the opportunistic person in me looks at the presidential candidates that are talking about this. They may be somewhat naive, perhaps, in how easy prevention is going to be implemented to save money. But certainly there's reason to hope that there is change that this country can embrace.
I'm always mindful of that remark attributed to Winston Churchill, that he said when his colleague said that these Americans are insufferable, and Winston Churchill reputatively said, well, not to worry, because America will do the right thing after we've exhausted all other possibilities. So I think maybe that is the message of hope as a practical matter. I can just add, in my last comment might be what it's meant for medicine and public health initiative. You know, it's one thing to go into an audience and say, we believe, I mean, MPHI, but it is something else again when you say, look at, let us show you what this national forum has done, both, and look who the participants are. These are all the people involved in the production of health, and particularly prevention. And if you see their publications, it is a mighty force. It doesn't make the day, but it certainly gets us well along the road. And I think you also couple, as you're saying, with simple old-fashioned community work where people connect by person to person, as we've always done since time immemorial. These are the focal points that I think national and local that will really, it does generate the change agents that we're speaking about. So let me thank you. And please, as I say, if you're interested in the forum, definitely visit the website. And please think about carrying the word out to others, local and within APHA, of the, as they say in Fast Times in Ridgemont High, this, you got to act like this is the place to be. So thank you all.